broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Point of View.
Monday to Thursday, 8 to 10 p.m.
15 minutes to 9 o'clock. Thanks so much for staying with us. I said to you today, we are going to have a conversation with the provincial candidates. We start that series today and we'll be lining them up. So lots of them coming through. But today we're going to be starting with the UDM candidate. Now, you may remember the name Mthunzi Mdwaba. Do you? Well, that name may sound familiar, but we're not going to really get into the details of how you remember him. I don't think this particular conversation is about that, but I'm sure he's very willing as a candidate running for the province of Gauteng. He's very happy to take your questions, but he is going to be in studio with us in a short while. We'll have a conversation about what he's offering, what is he willing to help this province with. As I said, this is going to be an ongoing conversation as we look to the elections 2024. So the hashtag is elections on Kaya. That's the hashtag. And you may follow all of these politicians that we've been talking to. We've been doing a lot of conversations around manifestos and candidates that are going for the national ballot. And so we are going to start a series where we look at the provincial candidates as well. So Mthunzi is in studio. I'm just giving him a moment to settle. But he is here. And you're welcome to call in 086-000-0959. You can also start sending those voice notes as well as we start asking him questions about his political future and what he has to offer the province of Gauteng. Well, let me welcome him into studio. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Take a sip of water. Anything, yes, you know, yes. You're welcome. Thank you so much for coming through.
Yes, it's a huge pleasure. It's just that I thought I still had about 15 minutes, you know, to warm up to this.
You know, but, you're now a politician.
Soldiers, right? need to find a way to
you're
get
now a politician. You're
into going, the hang of
this
things.
This is part of being agile. this is part of being agile. You know, things happen in politics. So this is you being agile. Okay, your relationship with the UDM, when did that start?
My relationship with the UDM is a very young one.
Okay.
In that it started literally on the 19th of February. Okay. So I'm under 2 months old in the UDM, but life has been moving rather fast in the UDM because a week ago, a few days ago, the leaders of the UDM, the top six,
yes,
made a decision that I should be the face for Gauteng.
So why the UDM when you were making up that
You know, that everybody's decision? Asked me this question so many times, but I still think I should pay attention and not leave out some detail.
Yeah.
So for starters, I just never thought I would be in politics. I
think really?
Let's start there. No.
Really?
No.
Okay.
I've accepted that perhaps I was in denial for many years.
Yes.
I have friends who have suggested it before, and I kept on saying, no, it's not for me. I'll stay as a business activist, which mm-hmm. is really what I was doing even when I was in Switzerland for many years. Mm. But I tend to think that around about November, December, I started experiencing a little bit of some kind of recruitment drive by some parties where
okay.
they were trying to reach out on X mm. and on other platforms for me to join them. I think then maybe the seed was sown that perhaps I need to think about it a little bit seriously if people keep knocking on my door. Then beginning of the year, I started talking to the same friends who for years had said I must look into politics to help me, if I was to make the decision, sort of find one party that would be in alignment with me in mm-hmm. terms of my core values, mm-hmm. My beliefs, and the fact that my personal drive has always been my purpose of global change and global impact and global social justice. And therefore, you've got to start at the local level, right? You can't just do global without doing what you do at home. And on the day that there was the State of the Nation address, it was a Thursday, that's all I mm-hmm. remember, I was invited to some TV channel to do an analysis of the State of the Nation address, and they crossed over to Parliament. Mm. And there was this young man talking, and as he was talking, I said, who's that? And they said, that's Ngabayomzi Gwankwa. Mm. I said, and he is? And they say, he's the deputy president of UDM. I said, my God, okay, he's talking a lot of sense. Mm. And then I continued with, you know, and then we're listening to them. And I said to the colleague next to me, who were both there as analysts, I said, I think that's the party. Mm. So he says, that's the party what? I said, that's the party I'm going to join, but let me do some homework. So I did some homework on the Friday, looked into, you know, the research on UDM, and I found that, you know, it has had no scandals. It is, from an ethical governance point of view, it is certainly, especially for 27 years, it was founded on that basis because the leader actually left the one party because of something that happened at the time. But when I started looking at the SAA Takatso deal, they were very instrumental in writing to Skopa and doing stuff. The Steinhoff deal, whether Marcus Joste killed himself or not, I don't know, some people don't seem to believe, but the Steinhoff, you know, saga and the billions that had been taken, you know, the UDM did that. Mm. And of course, the Speaker of Parliament resigning recently, you know, our president jokes about it. He says, you know, when he went to Parliament, he said, look, there's this, and the speaker at the time said, take me to the police station, go open a case. Mm. So now he jokes and he says, well, you said I must go to the police station and open a case, and now there you are, you're arrested. So all those, I think, is a combination. For me, I started thinking, what does moral regeneration look like? Or rather, just one step before that, what does South Africa that is different look like? Mm-hmm. And because I think I've been very occupied with anti-corruption over the last, I don't know, 12 months, 13 months of my life, even though I've acted in issues like that before, now when I think back. But I think it was the most concentrated period where I was dealing with, you know, just corruption being a thing that I see is very systemic, is very structured in South Africa now. Every aspect of it almost has a value chain, corruption. The UDM stands, I think, against it and has a good track record.
I often think that all South Africans, black and white, at a certain age have at some level been affected by apartheid. Mm. And so you have scars all around us, some that are open wounds, some that are closed wounds. Mm. Were you from either ever a political home? Did you have some sort of, you know, relationship with the politics of this country? Maybe small, maybe not so small.
You know, again, those are kind of questions you think about and things you think about when you reach certain points of your life in your development. So my father and my uncle, we grew up knowing that there were Boko, there were PAC.
Yes.
I know that my father, to marry my mother, was saved by my uncle from going to prison for political activities, because my uncle became the excuse for him and the alibi for him not to be arrested back in the day. So you hear those sort of, you know, it's not a big thing that they talk about, but it comes up. Or, you know, maybe, you know, when Steve Biko died, you know, I saw everybody was crying and I was trying to figure out what had happened. And then they explained these stories, right? And then further into my life, certainly I lived 27 years of my life before 94, I think. I hope I'm correct. And then where I come from, we used to have these separate doors for whites and blacks.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, that's why when you say everybody's been touched by it, it was real. I remember the fights we used to have, you know.
At the park, you wouldn't sit on the bench.
No,
not allowed to, right? White people.
And I come from a rural village. I'm a rural boy. Mm-hmm. When we go to town, it's a small little town called Lady Grey where people go past to go to Tiffindale. I told them, I've never been to Tiffindale, but apparently it's in that direction. And then when you go to, like, serious town, you go to Aliwal North, which is called Aliwal Noord, right? And if you don't speak Afrikaans, nothing happens there. So you know, so when the 1976 boycotts were happening and the protests were happening, you know, you understand it. You take all that into that context. Oh, okay, this is what's happening. You're being forced to do this and forced to do that. And then I came to Joburg. And then into my studies, you university, you can't miss politics again, the Black Student Society versus others. But later on, when I was owning my own company, the funny story is that how I became a political, I would say semi-activist, because I wouldn't call myself a full activist, was because I was driving not far from Rivonia, what is that place?
Lily's Leaf.
Mm-hmm. I was not far from there. And then I see some ANC people in the park, and I stopped the car and I said to them, what are you doing? Why are you in the park? So they said, no, they're having a meeting. I said, sorry, you're having a meeting, but you're the ruling party. Okay, the ruling party meet in the park. They said, no, that's just how it is. And that was the Rivonia Heroes branch of the ANC.
I see.
This is around about 2002, 2003, I think.
Yes.
I just bought a company in Rivonia called Talk IT. We had a 3,500 square meter of building. I said, I'm sorry, but I have a building. I think you should come there. I then ended up being in the BC, the branch executive committee, and then that's when I started learning about BCs and PCs and all these things that are in politics. But I wasn't fully of an activist, but the ANC Youth League used to meet in my building, the ANC Women's League and the ANC main thing used to meet in my building. So that was the extent of my involvement, really.
And that was just from sort of looking from the outside in, you'd say. Not really with your teeth in it.
Not really with my teeth in it, although I was convinced eventually to be in the BEC.
Got you.
You know, they found it odd that I would give them my building and every week they would meet there. And I said, no, I just want you to be comfortable and just meet there. I became a member, of course, of Rivonia Heroes. A member of the ANC via Rivonia Heroes. So I ended up being in the BEC, but I wasn't like fully, because for me, what I was really doing was doing other transformational work. And this is the part I think a lot of people fail to understand, is that we all contribute differently to, I think, this thing called the struggle and this thing called transformation. And that's why I refuse for certain people to claim and to insist that they liberated us. I don't believe that's true, because we all contributed to our own liberation and the collective liberation of our people. I was very involved in the information communications technology liberation. I became a member of the Black Information Technology Forum, recruited by somebody who came to my offices at Talk and said he's looking for revolutionaries. And I said, well, what do you mean? I'm a rural boy, so what is a revolutionary? I wouldn't know except for what I've read in history and what I know from industrial sociology when I was at Vets. And he said, no, leave the identification of revolutionaries to us. We think you are, therefore you come. I ended up being a national chairman of the Black Information Technology Forum, and it was an organization that was there for ensuring that previously disadvantaged Black technicians, Black IT people, Black IT entrepreneurs would be, you know, fast tracked, and we could actually be able to have them on the same level as our white counterparts. At the same time, I ended up being the president of the Information Technology Association, which was the white side of the BITF, right? And then through those two organizations, I participated in the drafting of the information communications charter for this country. So those are things one would do. But even when you did that, you had to be in touch with what's happening on the ground in terms of political organizations. You got to consult. You got to hear what their views are. So that was the extent of my activism, really, in politics.
And so with that journey, you then make the decision to go join the UDM. I'm assuming, of course, after what we've seen publicly play out in the media and the public gallery, you were clearly not going to the ANC.
No. You know what is said is that, so for many years when I left South Africa and ended up being in Switzerland, you find yourself in a very strange kind of situation where every time things that are not good or bad things happening at home, politically and otherwise, you find yourself in an automatic defensive mode, right? And I never used to understand it. You just go into it. I think it's being patriotic, right? You know it's wrong. I think that's the part that used to like really completely mystify me. So I know it's wrong what happened, but when somebody says, "Why did they do that?"
It's not unique. Everybody, most people,
you go into, yeah, well, you know, you need to understand, you know, if you're in South Africa, you know, if you have so many ways of justifying. And yet, you know, deep down when you go to bed that, I think I lied. I think, yeah, it's a lie. I made a story up, right? And we would do that for years. And I remember a time when you were in the United Nations, in the International Labour Organization and whatever you, and you, somebody pressed a button and said, South Africa, everybody would turn and look. South Africa was held in such high regard, right? And then fast forward, you know, I go through quite a number of very strange, bizarre situations. The previous Minister of Labour asks me, lobbies me and her team for 2 years to be available as a candidate for the first African Director General of the ILO. I had been the first African to be the Vice President of all employers in the world, looking after 150 countries, speaking for like over 50 million companies. And by virtue of being the Vice President of the IOE, I became the Vice Chairman, again, first African to be Vice Chairman of the International Labour Organization, 187 members, South Africa is one of them, country members. So from that, the only progression is you either going out or you're going to be executive, as opposed to being a non-executive chair, as one of the chairs. So I agreed eventually. It took me 2 years. Consulted with my kids, told them, look, I thought I was coming home, but patriotic call. I need to do this. And I remember saying to her, you know, I'm not used to agreeing to certain things where my decision or what will happen with me has to be reliant on outside forces. I said, you know, when I become a candidate, the government of South Africa needs to own me and own the campaign. So will that happen? Because, you know, I'd had situations before, because I used to be vice president of BUSA as well, of Business Unity South Africa, and I know politics is a very dicey kind of game, right? And she said, no, I'll be there. I said, but you won't be a minister anymore. She says, no, Ngane, I'll be there. True to form, she left. There was another minister. I thought we were good. I was chairing Productivity South Africa at the time. And before I knew it, it took me a while to realize that actually is working against my campaign. And it was like quite strange because I was a South African candidate. But I was picking up little stompies, you know, from people that, no, he didn't say something good about you there. He didn't say something good about you. Eventually, it became very clear I was being decampaigned. Fast forward, I go right to the end of it and, you know, everybody's shocked. I find my own campaign. Everybody else I was competing with, they were funded about $1.5 million, Swiss francs and so on. Me, I fund my own campaign. And here's the irony. So the ambassador of South Africa to the Geneva was apparently panicking because they had thought I would withdraw when they decampaigned me. He was apparently panicking and running around the corridors lobbying against me.
Why do you think that happened?
Because I don't leak people's backsides. That's why I think. I mean, so it's like it happened because, you know, we are responsible for it, I think, as the citizens and as a public, is that we create a lot of deityship. We create a lot of gods in people. We raise people onto levels that themselves they cannot perform, but you know what? They have to find some kind of way of showing that they're in control and in charge.
So when did it ultimately break, this relationship?
I don't know. You know, I wish I could tell you. I have no clue. You know, it's like...
You can't pinpoint
it. I can't pinpoint
moment.
It. I've tried. I've tried to do introspection and to try and do some kind of regressive thinking of my own. But I can't quite pinpoint it except to say that it was becoming clearer and clearer that the more I tried, especially as chairman of Productivity South Africa, I mean, I remember one particular incident, and I don't know if it is that. I don't know if maybe that was the camel, the straw that broke the camel's back for them. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, you always do your annual reports, and you talk about productivity. And productivity in this country was on the decline year on year, has been. Competitiveness was on the decline year on year. I, as part of the board of Productivity SA and as the chair, got to see firsthand how we were dropping in terms of the index, right? The Institute for Management Development Index. We are now 61 out of 63 countries, I think. You know, we're about to scrape the bottom of the barrel. And it tells you the report. It tells you what things you can do different. It tells you where you can make interventions. It tells you how you can make corrective things in the short to medium to long term so that, you know what, you can change things very quickly. And every time we send stuff to the guys, instead what would come back would be, I mean, this particular minister said, yeah, you know, he can't agree to me attacking his government. I said, sorry, I'm not attacking your government. It's my government too. And I'm not attacking. I'm simply outlining the truth and the facts of why we are in a continuous kind of messy situation and how we can correct it. I'm part of the problem and I want to be part of the solution as we do it. And eventually it got so bad that I had to threaten him that if he doesn't sign our performance thing, that I'm going to have to, you know, expose him that he's not doing it. Apparently, he found that I could have done this because somebody apparently told him that, look, this guy is not a full box of chocolates. He can do it. He's not just threatening you. He'll do it. And then, so that's the only kind of thing I can think of, because I had to tell him on messages on WhatsApp that, you know, Minister, you seem to think that you can monopolize patriotism. I don't see how you monopolize patriotism. And also this thing that you guys who think you liberated other people that were in the struggle, I'm sorry, it doesn't work like that. All of us have fought for this country in different ways. Other people have suffered far more than us who were not even active, whether a little bit or, you know. So I think, I don't know. So you can see I'm searching. I don't know when it finally came to a head. I just know that for me, when I started having the situation now where, you know, with my bribery allegations and other things that I was doing, I started realizing how deep this is. It you know, and even when I came out, by the way, I was doing it for me. Mm-hmm. Because I thought, you know what, I'm going to do the right thing so I can sleep well at night. But it was only after I had done it, and when everybody was calling me, when I started having thousands of people contacting me on X and contacting me on LinkedIn, then I realized, my God, this thing is not for me. It's not about me. It's much bigger than me. The messages I was reading on LinkedIn, and people were scared to say it on the public platform. They were, yes, saying it on the private side, yes, telling me their stories.
So when you say you then realize it was bigger than you, what did it then seem like it was?
I was supposed to be a lawyer and I didn't become a lawyer.
Yes.
And some people have asked me why. Because I went into entertainment law. I was trying to avoid, I think, being a lawyer, in the sense that I realize you end up having people's problems to deal with. You're like a social worker as a lawyer, right? You take people's problems home with you and they're confidential. I can't come and say, you know, I get home to my ex-wife or something at the time and say, you know, look, you know, this happened today. I can't. You know, you can speak maybe, you know, in roundabout ways, but you can't say so-and-so came to my office, right? So I left. So coming back now, for me, it was the first time that I felt like I was being taken back to that world where people are sharing confidential information about their depressive situation. And it was, and I don't believe I've ever been depressed, although I don't know now. I'm like, I was thinking about it the other day. Have I been depressed? Yeah, I was thinking, I've never been depressed. But you know when you don't know what it looks like? So maybe I've been depressed. Because at that time, I remember that the coming out, about the problems and people wanting to block my contract because I have to pay something for it as per the middle persons that were coming to me was not as depressive, even though people told me that I could be killed. I mean, so first of all, I was getting used to that, and my mother calling me now morning and evening, which she still does, to check if I'm okay. If I don't say good morning or good night, there's a problem. Mm. Today, my team was not able to contact me for an hour and a half. Do you know how panicky they were? When I read the messages, they were like, where is he? What happened? Why is he not responding? I mean, that's tragic, right? But all of that, I factor. But when I was reading the messages about dreams that were shattered, lives that were destroyed, people that had committed suicide, people, I mean, it was like, no, is it that bad? But and some of these messages come from people that, from a status orientation point of view, you'd think these are people who can fight their own fights, you know? But clearly they can't, for some reason. Clearly they are locked into the system, and it's a system where if you don't play by these rotten, corrupt rules, you perish.
So with all of that, you still choose politics.
Hey, man. You see, I think there's an element of me that's a bit stupid too.
You're sucker for punishment.
Yeah, no, me, I've never been well. I think I've had to accept that there's always been a part of me that, you know, even when I was in the United Nations, when I knew I was fighting big stuff, if you disrespected me, I think I have a trigger of disrespect. If you demonstrated disdain, or you were being manipulative, mm-hmm. bordering on bullying, then I lose it.
So is that the drive?
I think that's the drive.
You think that's the drive?
Especially when I see it being done on people who can't even defend themselves. Now, you know, I always use this theory. I always say, you know, I hate the fact that I stood in a queue the one time to go and renew my license. My PA said, no, boss, I know people who can stand in the queue for you. So I said, no, I want to go to the queue myself. Big mistake. That's when I realized I'm stupid. So I went to this queue from 6 o'clock. Yeah, man, it's cold in Kempton Park upstairs. She says, no, the best one is that one, gay. If you're going to stand in the queue, go to that one. So I stand there, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. When I'm close, the queue is long, I'm close. They say, no, the systems have died. What do you mean systems have died? No, the system is off. And then it's not coming back. No. Haibu. Now, I remember exactly what my first thought was standing in that queue. Mm. It wasn't necessarily about me. Mm. I was thinking, okay, this is wrong. Mm. I've been cold standing in this queue for 4 or 5 hours. I don't know when I'm going to make time again. Make time, eh? The other people on the queue don't make time. They are not in control of their time. Mm. Their time is controlled by somebody else, or they are looking for a job. And if he doesn't have that license that day, he's never getting a job again, right? And I hate that because, you know, and of course, me, I had a choice. I was going to go to Artebees. I've got another home not far from from Artebees. I can go there and whatever. That turned out to be a disaster too, but that's a different story for a different day. But the point, though, is that I hate this thing that everything caters for people who have choices. You can make a plan, as my PA was saying, I can get somebody to do it. Mm. Now, the same applies with this situation that I can't stand it when I think that, you see, when things don't work, I could go and live in Switzerland. Mm. I've got so many friends all over the world, right? But I hate to think that I can do that. But 95% of the people in this country can't do that. That for me just makes me really angry, right? And also I always think when I want something, I know somebody who knows somebody. Even if I don't know the person who's going to make the decision, I'm likely to know someone who knows someone who knows that person. It shouldn't work like that though. And that is the other thing that upsets me. I'm thinking, okay, I'm doing it because I can. But what about the multitudes who can't do it? So those kind of things are a problem for me, which is why I always explain to people, my kids have come to understand. I say, you know, for me, my purpose, which I came to know a few years ago, is is global change, global impact, and global social justice. And it's not a joke. It's serious for me, right? I've had to unpack it and say, okay, this change, why is it so difficult? And this impact, why is it other people don't care for the impact? It took me a while to get it. And then social justice, how... When you are in an institution like the ILO, you talk social justice every day. But I see how my very colleagues in the very multilateral agency, they talk from both sides of the mouth. They lie. They're hypocrites. Right?
I wanted to open the lines up for those who are interested in having a conversation with you. We're in conversation with Mthunzi Mdwaba. He is now the provincial candidate of the UDM. And we're going to be discussing this province. And you can call in 086-000-0959. You can also send an X at Pimelo Martinez, where you can find us at Kai 959. You can also send a voice note 063-600-0959. Okay, so you understand this very well. To come up with solutions, you must first diagnose the problem.
Yes.
What's wrong with Gauteng?
There's a lot wrong with Gauteng. There's a lot wrong with South Africa. So Gauteng, we all know it's trite, is the largest province in South Africa. We account for 33% of the GDP of this country, 165 billion, the majority of which goes to health and education. Economic development gets a very minute little allocation for some reason that is very obscure to me. But, you know, that's just the numbers, you know.
The small business hardly gets anything.
Right? Yeah, no. I mean, how are you going to get anything, you know? But what for me, what is striking is that the very health and education that gets the bulk...
The biggest is the
is
the
rotten, right? I was invited a year and a half ago by cardiologists and oncologists at the convention center. They had an annual congress, and they got to me through somebody, and they took me to dinner because I said to them, I need to understand, why would you want me to speak at your congress? I know nothing about medicine. They said, no, actually, we don't need somebody to talk to us about medicine. We want somebody to talk to us about how to cope. They said, we're not coping. We have struggles that have nothing to do with medicine. They have something to do with management or lack thereof at our hospitals. They gave me figures that shocked me about how, you know, we'd move down to, I don't know, number 16 for oncology, number what, I don't know, for cardiology, where I used to think naively, I thought we were still number one. I thought, no, but South Africa has to be. They said, no, it hasn't. And they were telling me they need inspiration. They need to be inspired. They need motivation. And I had to go and speak to them to motivate them, right? Now, and we spend so much money on it. So where does the money go? That's the million-dollar question, right? And then you look at SMMEs. You look at jobs. You look at SMMEs. And remember that when you talk about SMMEs, you have to talk about different kinds of SMMEs. There's the kind of SMMEs that would be, you know, on an international benchmark kind of SMME because they're in the formal sector. Everybody understands from a size, from a turnover, from a number of people employed. But then there's the SMME that is not even accounted for. That's in the informal sector, right? The one that makes up about 60 to 65% of our economy of South Africa. Indeed, the most of the developing world will be 65, 75, 85, 95%, depending on where you are in the world. That part for me is where we should be focusing on to effect change and to have this impact one talks about, right? There it's not happening for a number of reasons, whether it's access to finance because our developmental finance institutions have still not learned that you can't continuously be a funder of last resort. You can't go and say, no, go first, get Mthunzi to fund you or to partner with you. When you found Mthunzi to partner with you, you can come back to us. We pledge to match. No. In a developmental state, I mean, sort of...
secure a deposit or a fee, and then come back. Tell us that they've given you
Ganja.
A surety that you will come back to us and then go back to them and then they'll give you a portion.
What nonsense. And even some of the projects that I have in my model that has been delayed because it's been blocked by the powers that be, I have a number of projects where I've committed to funding 150 million, 160 million, 200 million, but they are not going to take off these projects, even though they are creating 15,000 jobs, 30,000 jobs, 20,000 jobs, until, so I know the IDC is there, the DBSA is there, they've all promised, but they're not going to start until I make that money available. So for 16 months, I've been blocked and delayed. So for 16 months, those jobs are not going to be created because we are waiting for the DFI to come in and only activate when I have been able to put that money down. Now, these are the kind of things that we need to change in this country. In this province that is the leading province, we should be demonstrating to National and influencing National to change its policies, to understand that in a developmental state paradigm, which is in our manifesto as the UDM, you can't behave like that. You need to be able to develop. And when you develop human capital. And when you develop human capital, it means it includes entrepreneurs. It includes them being enabled to create enterprises and creating sustainable enterprises to be able to have a sustainable economy.
But in influencing those policy decisions at national level is going to take some time.
Yes.
So what do you do here?
Well, what you do here, you also have to do that which you can be able to do yourself.
Yes.
And that is to be able to run programs that you have the power to initiate. And there's many, and it starts with, for example, at national level, we don't have an employment policy. And I want to keep repeating this for as many times as I can, because I don't know how we don't know that we don't have an employment policy. Nati, I don't know. Nati, as a citizenry, we're a bit slow sometimes. Because people come and tell us we have policies. And there was a time when South Africa used to have some of the best policies in the world. But the one that is very fundamental to us as a country that has amongst the highest unemployment rate in the world, we don't have. So Gauteng can very easily come up with its own ways of ensuring that we come up with teams that are going to audit, first of all, the skills that Gauteng has or does not have. And we, having done that, we then look at all these master plans that they are doing and see whether they cater for Gauteng. And we look at the sectors of the economy that are going to be pro-growth and that are going to have job-intensive elements in them. Because you see, this is the other thing that people make up stories. They'll tell you, no, you can't have jobs that are intensive and whatever because of technology. That's also a lie, right? And then you then need to say, what is the industrial policy? We don't have one either, right? So when you talk about black industrialists, you're talking about them in a vacuum. And once you've identified your skills that you have and not have, and you've identified what it is you need to put together to be able to partner in a way that is going to be constructive for Gauteng. For example, I know of a number of provinces in many parts of the world that want to partner with provinces, not national to national, but province to province, right? Like a province in China that wants to partner with Gauteng.
Cities partner with cities around the world.
You know, or some parts of Brazil or some parts of Russia who are our BRICS partners. You know, you need to do that. But to do that as well, you need to know what it is you're looking for.
Yeah.
So the challenge we have currently is that we have very inadequate deployees, incompetent is better than inadequate, right? Who have no clue. They are there to do what they are told at any given time, but it's not because they understand, you know, that for us to be able to change something in society, this is what we need to do.
Thanks very much for staying with us. Okay, so our guest is Mthunzi Mdwaba, who is here as a representative, the UDM provincial candidate. And this is a new series. We're going to do this every Tuesday. You're welcome to call in. You're welcome to ask all your questions, 086-000-0959. Let's quickly go straight to the voice notes. I hope, Mr. Mdwaba, you've got your cans. Do you have headphones? I'm going to organize headphones for you in a short while. I want to see if I've got a call while I organize the headphones. I'll do that because I do want you to hear, the voice notes.
The questions,
so while I do that, let me then ask you. You spoke a little bit about sectors mm-hmm. that we would have to target and focus on to try and grow the economy of the province.
Mm-hmm.
Just at the top of your head, what sectors are you talking about?
The sectors at the top of my head are agriculture. Mm-hmm. Agriculture will always be the biggest part that we need to focus on. And of course, within agriculture, there's so many possibilities. One of them being that very promising herb, a family
cannabis.
Of cannabis yeah. that we are taking years to just get it to be properly loosened, to be activated by small players for reasons that one cannot understand unless, you know, we have these big companies that are maybe wanting to have an unfair advantage over small companies, you know, in getting it to happen. But there's a lot other you can do in agriculture. You can do within Gauteng also your renewable energy, solar, battery storage that you can also do, which also, of course, helps us with the energy side of things in terms of the portfolio and the mix that we might be looking at, because that's very important. And that in itself then takes us into another area which is mostly ignored by the creatives. You know, the creative industry is an industry that everybody agrees is supposed to grow in leaps and bounds. At the moment, you may hopefully be aware that the UDM is supporting the creatives in their plight in terms of the Copyright Amendment Act and the Performers Protection Amendment Act as well. In ensuring that as we grow that sector, we don't do it in an exploitative manner that takes their rights away in terms of some usage in these acts and whatever. My background is in the creative industries because I used to be in the music industry a long, long time ago and I used to lobby for it. So that's a big area for me that I'm interested in, that I know we can grow.
So quickly while you're there, what's the UDM's position? Should it go back to Parliament or do you feel that the President needs to sign this character?
It must go back to Parliament.
It must go back. It's a
rubbish.
Yeah.
The President denies receiving letters, but we know he received them. We saw proof that he received these letters. But of course, the performers one is not bad, but it's just that it needs to be aligned together with the copyright one because there are certain clauses
Absolutely.
In the one Correct. That affect the other,
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So we need to have an aligned process. And then you've got the finance sector is doing very well in Gauteng, in South Africa as a whole, and in Gauteng. But at the same time, you have a very huge unhealthy concentration in the financial sector. You know, today you find the financial sector owns everything in this country, right? So we've put all our eggs in this financial sector, and you start having them funding a lot of these retail businesses that don't create jobs. You know, like you have this retail economy that is great for the people who've got money, the Woolworths of this world and the Pick n Pays of this world and the Checkers of this world. But you know what? It's not good for the people who are looking for jobs, right? You then have as well the sport. Sport is not looked at as something we should be growing. I know of so many sports people in swimming, for example. I've watched swimming for years, where the swimmers that have done well in this country have had to go and be trained by people outside the country in places like Monaco, but not us catering for them here. And yet we are saying we want to create decent work and dignity. Now, it's almost like decent work and dignity means you must wear a tie and go into an office and be straitjacketed and whatever you. Those are the kind of things, I mean, if you look at cycling, for example, a big passion of mine. Why in South Africa don't we have a thriving cycling sports environment? You know, there's so many of those areas, but ultimately, when you look in innovation in terms of ICTs, for me, that's where we're lacking the most. When I talk about an employment policy and I talk about an industrial policy, why don't we have a future of work, fourth industrial revolution, artificial intelligence policy for our country and for Gauteng leading that kind of conversation?
So the energy sector.
Yeah.
Currently, we do have some signed agreements between ourselves and other countries, and of course, you're saying, you know, battery storage facilities and all of that. We have a lot of people who want to bring that technology in. What's your suggestion? Are you saying that we invest in bringing those those technologies in? Are you saying that we must create an environment where we innovate ourselves?
I say the priority must be to innovate ourselves. The priority must be to ensure that we create things that we own the intellectual property of ourselves. It's too much that every time we let things go out of our country, we allowed it with the other sectors where we had no say, you know, pre our time and whatever. But we can't continue to create opportunities for the outside world. It is okay for them to partner and complement us.
Please put your headphones on. I've got a voice note coming through. I've got a few, but let's play this very first one.
Prof speaks a lot about friendships. I'd like to find out what's his take on CADA deployment.
All right. Did you hear the question?
My take on CADA deployment.
Mm-hmm.
My take on CADA deployment is that it has contributed to the destruction of this country. Because, you see, when you deploy in anything that you deploy in, you have to deploy in a constructive, structured, strategic way in which we build. But when you deploy incompetent people into anything, it's a recipe for disaster. Or if you are to deploy somebody on the basis of potential, because you must remember from a human capital point of view, sometimes you don't have to find ready people. You find people who show potential to be ready. Now, when that person has the potential, you then owe it to them as part of that deployment project that is looking at a constructive thing for the collective of South Africa, that you surround them with people they will listen to, they will learn from, and that will help them.
So you're not necessarily against the policy itself. Where do you think it's going wrong?
You see, I'm not against natural stuff. You know, the whole world, people tend to rely on groupings of people they know can help them build something, put something together, and whatever. It's natural behavior. The difference with us is that we tend to go and pull the people who are incompetent, one, or who have huge egos the size of planets and will not listen to people that advise them around them, and then they want to take over from people who must make decisions. Or for that matter, you have a situation where you allocate budgets to these people and then you never see anything happen. If it's a bridge, the bridge never comes up. If it's a house, the house never comes up. So for me, then that's something is wrong with it. Then you must revisit it. And I'm not saying throw the bath out with the baby out with the bathwater, but you know, if you can't get it right, then maybe you must just do away with it.
I've got one last voice note, Mguni. Let's take a listen.
I'm glad tonight I'm listening to Mthunzi Dwaba and what is said, particularly on this country not having an employment policy. All these parties, all these come politicians and they wanna be politicians will create employment, I'll create employment. How? They don't say. So, first of all, as Dwaba is alluding, you need to have a plan. How are you going to create that employment? And the policy will definitely assist you towards achieving that. I so wish in my heart that in this country we can wake up as citizens to understand who's fooling us, who's just there being a politician, blabbering, talking nonsense, and who has the intentions, true intentions, at least. Because that the pudding will be the taste will be the pudding at the end of the day. But I just hope Mdwaba makes it. It's unfortunate that UDM people don't support UDM, but maybe, who knows? It might happen in Gauteng that they get the majority votes. And good luck to you, Mdwaba. Good luck to you.
Hopefully you
make it and become a premier. Let's see if things can change.
Thank you.
So we don't have much time, but we've had a lot of time. We just ran out of time.
Yes.
You're not going to be collaborating with the ANC, I imagine, if the need arises.
Well, I think first of all, for me, I always want to be truthful. So that decision does not lie with me. it lies with the collective in the UDM. I think we would have to look at what is best for the UDM. But I would think it's very unlikely, though, because, you know, we need to align with people that have our values. Mm-hmm. You remember I mentioned moral regeneration. I don't see how the ANC can regenerate anything morally, quite frankly. So I think I would vote no very strongly with my leadership and my colleagues.
And why would you be the best candidate to make sure that Gauteng gets back on his feet?
Because I'm not a theoretician. I don't, you know, it's not a theoretical conjecture thing. It's based on experience. I've built companies. I'm a turnaround specialist. I thrive in turnaround situations, which is what Gauteng is. Gauteng is a mess. Service provision, whether it's water, whether it's lights, whether it's anything, we need to just fix things and maintain things and build and enhance. And I think for me, I work well in teams. I love teams. I love when I'm talking about surrounding yourself with people. I always have been very good in choosing the right kind of teams, people that are much smarter than me, because, you know, there's not a place for egos. It's a place where you want to deliver. You're looking for solutions to challenges that we have. And Gauteng has many of those challenges. And in terms of our manifesto, we have a very, very solution-oriented manifesto, but we're also alive to the fact that we must prioritize the needs of Gauteng before we use the manifesto as a Bible.
All the best. Thank you for coming through.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.